Welcome to Thinking Aloud, a podcast about the nexus of politics and all those things that make us human. From the College of Arts and Humanities at Lindenwood University, I'm your host, Don Heidenreich. Events of the last few years have shown the importance of understanding faiths and their backgrounds and their experiences and how they view the world. And one of the faiths that we as Americans in particular could use more of an introduction to is Islam. Today I have as my guest Reverend Dr. Nicole Drabitsky. She is an associate professor of religion at Lindenwood University. Thank you for being here, Dr. Drabitsky.
Oh, so glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
So what are the things that we should initially know in order to understand Islam?
This religion, this religious tradition, has come on the scene in important ways. A lot of misunderstandings, but also a lot of good understanding and a lot of good working together. Now, here in the St. Louis area, now that things have changed, the situation has changed in Afghanistan, we'll be bringing 1,400 new neighbors from Afghanistan to live with us. And all of those people, as far as we know, are Muslim. So in the greater St. Louis area and in the United States, we have more and more neighbors who are Muslims from abroad, and then also more and more people who are homegrown Muslims. So it is, I think, a good idea for us to know a little bit about this religion.
So what are the primary tenets of Islam?
Oh, yeah, give the five-minute speech on this thousands of years old religion. So Islam started in what's now called Saudi Arabia, so in the Arabian Peninsula, before Arabia was under the control of the Saudi family, with a man named Muhammad. Muhammad was known to be a man of faith, was not at the time either Jewish or Christian, but understood the idea of the importance of one God. Muhammad was known for going out into the hills above Mecca and spending a great deal of time in prayer and meditation. In one of these times away from home, he's visited by the angel Gabriel. And Gabriel has a new revelation for him, words from God about how humanity should be behaving itself. And so beginning with this encounter with the angel Gabriel and over the next 23 years, Muhammad gets revelations from God about how we ought to be organizing our lives. These revelations are recorded in the Quran. And one of the most important tenets of Islam is that God is one. So the major statement of faith of Islam is called the Shahada. And it says, very simply, that there is only one God, and Muhammad is God's messenger.
Is Muhammad in any way the equivalent of Jesus?
Ah, that's a lovely question to ask, and very good. So for those of you who might not be familiar with Christianity, for Christians, they believe that this person, Jesus Christ, the founder of their faith, was a human being, but was also the Son of God. And so Christians believe that Jesus Christ is fully human and fully divine, and therefore Christians can worship Jesus because of Jesus' fully divine status. And so they're not breaking that first commandment. Muslims, who are also people who follow the books that Christians and Jews consider the Bible, they also follow that first commandment that Christians and Jews and Muslims have, that there are no other gods, only one God. So when we think about who Muhammad is, we can't think about that human being in terms of Jesus Christ. Muhammad is not divine. Muhammad is perfect and is the perfect example of what it means to be a human being, but is not the Son of God, is not divine, and Muslims do not worship Muhammad. So they hold Muhammad in a great deal of respect, sacred, high regard, worthy of admiration and emulation for sure, but is never worshiped because that violates our command to only worship God.
What are some of the basic things that are required of a Muslim within the Quran?
So the Quran itself talks about these things, which become explained better in another set of very important and sacred texts called the Hadiths. So there are these things in Islam called the five pillars. If you're at all familiar with Islam, you might have heard of these before. These are the five pillars of belief, or really the five pillars of action that all Muslims are supposed to engage in order to practice their religion faithfully. And the beginnings of these are all found in the Quran, but the details are all spelled out in the secondary literature called the Hadith. And basically they say the first pillar is this Shahada that I have already mentioned, that God is one and that Muhammad is the messenger of God. The next is prayer, right? Salat. So there are five daily prayers that everybody who's Muslim engages in. And these are ritual prayers. So there's movements that go along with things that everybody recites at the same time. So you memorize these things and you memorize the movements. And everyone gathers, sometimes in a mosque, but you can do prayers anywhere and you can do them alone. But you stop what you're doing five times a day and pray. There are other kinds of prayers. These are called dua, but those aren't the formal prayers that are part of this pillar. The next one is zakat, which is giving. So every Muslim person is supposed to give 2% of their income every year. And in certain places in the world, like say America, this is a donation that you make to your mosque. In other places in the world, it's collected by your government as kind of a tax and then used for social support. Though it doesn't necessarily pay people's salaries, it's supposed to be used to help as a social safety net. Fasting, swam, is the next one. And this is for the month of Ramadan. So there's a particular month that all people who are Muslim fast from sunup to sundown. And by fasting, that means no food and no water. So it's a long, very long days of not having any food or anything to drink. And then when the sun goes down, everybody kind of relaxes. They go home and hang out with their families on Friday evening. Sometimes there are street parties in places where there's a Muslim majority, where people gather to kind of celebrate and party. Just the moment the sun goes down, people have their first bite of food, because I don't know about you all if you've ever fasted, but it takes some effort to get through a day. The Hajj is the next one. And so during a Muslim's lifetime, if they have the financial wherewithal, everyone is supposed to make a trip to Mecca. We use the word pilgrimage. Travel from wherever they're living in the world and spend about a week in the city of Mecca where Muhammad was born and where the sacred structure called the Kaaba is housed. And also it attached to the Kaaba is the black stone, which is a symbol of God. It is not God, and the stone itself is not worship. It's a symbol of God, and so it's sacred. And people spend about a week doing several different practices to help increase your faith and show your dedication, and but also be together with sometimes millions of other Muslims from around the world. Every language on the planet is spoken in Mecca during this time with millions of people. It is, though, not a party, because we remember that Muslims do not drink alcohol. So the command when you go on the Hajj is to be modest and circumspect. That's a big word for saying on your best behavior. Right? No arguing, no losing your temper, no being impatient. Just everybody take a deep breath. We're all in Mecca. We're all the same in front of God. It'll all be fine.
What is the relationship between particularly Christianity and Islam?
So in the academic study of religion, we like to call Judaism, Christianity, and Islam the Abrahamic faiths, because all three of these religions can trace their first ancestor back to this man named Abraham, who shows up in what Jews call the Torah or the Tanakh, what Christians call the Old Testament, and then what Muslims would call the Book. So Muslims often call this group of people of the Book, because we all share a similar book and a similar story, all claiming Abraham as an ancestor. Muslims claim Abraham as an ancestor through Abraham's oldest son, firstborn, Ishmael. And the idea is that there's a lot of commonality in how these religions understand themselves and how they run their religions. This idea that they're monotheistic, there's only one God that you're only allowed to worship, and Muslims have a few things to say to Christians about this whole Jesus thing. So for Christians see Jesus as also God. Like, is God, and therefore not breaking the first commandment by worshiping God. Muslims have a slightly different view of who Jesus is. Muslims look at Jesus and see another prophet. So a prophet that came before Muhammad, but after, say, Moses, one of the most important prophets in Judaism, and has important things to say, particularly to Christians. And so Jesus shows up in the Quran and is respected and important in some ways to Islam, but not as a fully divine person and not as one we would worship, because our worship is supposed to be directed solely to God. But Jesus is a prophet and has very important things to say. And the way Islam sees how the world will work, how it eventually might come to an end, is that one day Jesus will return. So there really is this idea that Jesus is a Messiah who came to save, who came to teach people the right way to go, and that when God decides to bring paradise about on earth again, the trumpets will sound and Jesus will return and judgment will happen. For Muslims, judgment is based entirely on one's own deeds. Right, so God keeps a list. Like, technically, you have two angels, one who sits on each shoulder, and the good deeds that you do get kept, written down on this list. As a matter of fact, any good deed that you actually do is written down 10 times, or you get 10 good deeds. And if you do a bad thing, you disobey, or you do something that's wrong, that gets written down one time. Now, if you ponder doing a good deed, if you intend to do a good thing but you don't get around to it or you forget to do it, your angel will still write that deed down in your book for you. But if you think about doing a bad thing, right? I was contemplating breaking the rules. Well, your angel just looks the other way. Like, that contemplated deed that goes undone doesn't get written down. So this goes to a key component about the oneness of God for Islam is that God is merciful and just. So when Jesus returns and Judgment Day comes, Muslims stand in front of the judge with their book and God tallies it up. Did you do more good than bad? Awesome. Paradise for you. Did you do more bad than good? Well, there might be some time in hell for you. Unlike Christians, who are like, well, okay, I believe in Jesus, but my list of things is not really all that great. Like, I didn't do a great job living up to all of those things that Jesus asked me to do. And so as Christians envision it, just follow me on the metaphor, we're standing in line on our judgment day and we have our books and we get right up there before the throne, and then Jesus switches books with us and we get to hand Jesus's book to God. So in some ways, this is a lovely way of thinking about salvation in Christian terms, but in Muslim terms, they see that as kind of unjust, as not holding people to accountability. Now, the lovely thing about Islam, though, is if you end up in punishment, it's not eternal. So for Christians, if you're punished, your punishment lasts for eternity. But for Muslims, you shouldn't be punished eternally for a finite sin, for a finite problem. So after a certain amount of punishment, then you have an opportunity. You've figured out how you're supposed to behave and how to submit to what God wants us to do, and then eventually paradise for you. So it's a lovely way of looking at how the world works. And Jesus figures into that, just not quite in the same way that Jesus figures in for Christians.
One of the things that's interesting about Christianity, of course, is the fact that most Christians will say they understand that it is broken down into component parts, in the sense that it has had multiple sects that have been created over time with varying beliefs. Is this true in Islam as well?
There are some major divisions in Christianity, and I won't go into those, but there are major divisions in Islam as well, because human beings like to do it our way. So very early on in Muslim history, almost immediately after Muhammad's death, disagreement began over who should be the leader and who should be the person in charge. And this disagreement led to a split between the two major Muslim groups. One group, called the Sunni, consider that the word Sunni comes from the Arabic word sana, which means tradition. So these people consider themselves the traditionalists. They're following the traditions that Muhammad started. Now, the other group, the other major group of Muslims, call themselves Shia, and that means in Arabic the party of Ali. So these are the people who said, well, if you love the Prophet, then you ought to love the Prophet's family. And as it turns out, Ali is Muhammad's son-in-law, and so therefore he ought to be the leader. And from this division came a different sets of traditions and slightly different sets of belief. So if we were to tease apart for someone who wasn't Christian the difference between a Presbyterian and a Methodist, it would boggle their mind, the minutiae, how small the differences are to an outsider, but how giant the differences are to an insider. So if for those of us who are on the outside looking in, it's difficult for us to determine the difference between someone who is Sunni or the difference between someone who is Shia. But the people who practice this religion, they know the differences. It is a big deal. And in some cases, though, it's not. So there are places in the world where you go and you ask, are you Sunni? Are you Shia? And they're like, I submit to God. I'm Muslim. So is it an artificial distinction? No, because this historical thing happened and there are differences now between Shia populations. Most of our Shia population is found in Iran and Iraq, and the rest of the world is basically Sunni, including the world's largest Muslim country, Indonesia. So most of the Muslims in the world aren't even found in the Middle East. Most of them are found in Indonesia. There's a third group of Muslims, and these are the Sufis. So how are they different? Well, they kind of are a really interesting mix of Sunni and Shia beliefs with a little bit more mystical bent. So they pick up the rule following from the Sunni, and they pick up the mystical stuff from the Shia. And if you were to ask them what they are, they're I follow God. Perhaps the more interesting question, and I know we don't have time to get into this, is the school of law you use in Islam. It might have less to do with what party you belong to, Sunni or Shia, and it might have more to do with what school of law your community follows as they enact actual legislation and as they do, say, case law in countries. And most of those are going to be from a school of jurisprudence, right, a school of law called Hanafi.
That's where you can have the conversation that oftentimes religious reformers come in and have an idea, and then what you begin to see is that by the generation after them, new leaders are reverting to the old cultural norms and using law and the religion to enforce these old ideas. And these become local. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that Christianity, I believe, did was kind of reach out and adapt itself to the local people in such a way that it became more acceptable. So that leads to a question, though, of leadership. How is leadership defined in Islam? We know, such as in the Catholic Church, that many Catholics, have a discussion on that one, believe Rome has the ultimate say over what Catholicism actually means. It's different among many of the Protestant faiths. Does Islam have anything equivalent to this?
There is an educated clergy in Islam for both Sunni and Shia, and regardless of what school of jurisprudence you happen to adhere to. The leadership of a local mosque is called an imam, and that simply means the one who stands in front. So in general, as some of you might be aware, the daily prayers happen 5 times a day. If you go to a mosque, men are required to go to the afternoon prayers at the mosque. The one who stands in front to lead those prayers is the imam. Most often, the imam is also pretty well educated, or if you live in a very, very small town, the imam is the person who is the most educated man in your town. But as Islam spread and education grew, people started to gather in schools called madrasas and study Muslim law, study the Quran, study the hadiths, start to talk about what it means, like who God is and how, like all of this theology developed around this. And so many imams that you would meet today are people who have been educated as Muslim clergy, but not always. And the same thing happens in Christianity. You can have people who've gone to seminary who can call themselves pastor, and people who have not and who still get to pastor churches. It's not all that dissimilar in Islam. The leadership of who gets to run the Sunni or the Shia, it's not equivalent to how, say, there's a pope in the Roman Catholic Church. There are leaders of particular groups of Muslims, and they tend to be connected with the political structures of the particular country that they're in. There used to be the Shah. That's basically a word for a political leader, but who's also a religious leader. So there's all sorts of different kinds of leaders in Islam. There's imams. Those are the people who tend to run the mosques. They're the ones who stand in front. But there's also people who make legal judgments, who do what we call fiqh. And so those are the people who act more like judges. But there's also all sorts of different kinds of religious scholars that you would go to consult on a question of the Quran or on a point of behavior. And sometimes there's not a single opinion. And religious scholars from across the Muslim world will get together and hash it out, talk about all of the details, and then come to a decision collectively, sometimes over the course of years. And I can give an example if you like.
Please do.
Coffee. So when Islam was developing, coffee was not introduced to the Middle East. Now, the Quran has rules against drinking intoxicating beverages. So when coffee made it to the Middle East, can we drink it or is it outlawed? And as you can imagine, there were some people who saw the stimulant effects of coffee and said, no, you can't drink it. It's too much like any other intoxicating beverages. And then there were others who were like, okay, let's stop and think about that for a second. And there was about 100 years of arguing, 200 years of arguing over whether it was acceptable for Muslims to drink coffee or not. And in the end, thankfully, it is.
And so, if anyone's ever had Turkish coffee, you know.
It's true. It's some of the best coffee in the world. So thank you to the early Islamic scholars who decided together and over the course of many years that coffee is an acceptable drink. So who says in Islam, the ulama, the gathered community of believers, they say. Now, in certain sects like Shia, there are imams who have more authority, so might be closer to what we would consider a pope or a cardinal, but it's not quite that unified. So in many ways, much like Christianity, so there are people who are Roman Catholic and they follow the pope, but there's Orthodox Christians and they follow the patriarch, and then there's a bunch of us Protestants and Pentecostals and Mormons, and we follow the particular leaders of our individual churches. So it's not, and Islam is a lot like that. There's not just one person calling all of the shots anymore.
Is there a way to think about particularly the legal aspects of this? Would European canon law actually be somewhat of an equivalent to Islamic law?
Yeah, actually, I think it would. When the church has a say in what we might consider to be secular affairs, like an official say in what we might consider to be secular affairs, that's a fair enough analogy to draw. So in Islam, because God is one, and because God is in charge of everything, it makes absolutely no sense to pass laws that aren't in keeping with the teachings found in the Quran and the hadiths. So, of course, we're going to pass laws that say selling alcohol in our country is illegal because God says don't drink alcohol. So, therefore, there isn't any reason to sell it, and therefore, you can't sell it.
When many people in the West think of Islam, they tend to think of it in one form that they've seen primarily in parts of the Middle East. But it appears that Islam has a great ability and capacity for adapting to the cultures in which it is in. What in Islam really allows for that?
We do tend to see Islam as as this kind of monolithic thing. Like, all Muslims look like someone who's from Iran or Saudi Arabia, which they don't – people who are Muslim don't dress at all similar in the same country, in those countries, completely different. So we have this idea of Islam that's not particularly true to the character of Islam, even though there are all sorts of rules to what it means to be Muslim. The specifics of how one dresses, which side of the road one can drive on, exactly how a property might be split up in a divorce, all of those things can vary because the Quran allows for local tradition, so long as it is in keeping with the statutes of what the Quran has to say. And so let's talk about women and veils. In Turkey and the United States, you are, according to those kinds of scholars, in keeping with the commands for modesty if you're wearing good baggy clothes and you've got your hoodie pulled up over your hair. Now, you'll get in trouble for that in Saudi Arabia. That's not in keeping with Saudi tradition about how women are supposed to cover their hair or their heads. So, but according to Muslim scholars, at least, so long as you are modestly dressed and you are covered appropriately, it doesn't matter exactly the configuration of the cloth, right? You can still pull your hoodie up and keep everything appropriately covered so long as it's baggy enough.
So local considerations are significant within the practice of Islam as well.
They certainly are, because each individual locality has its own needs and its own traditions. And so these are what the schools of jurisprudence developed to do, to help us to be sure that the laws and local customs are in keeping with what is consistent with the Quran and the Hadiths. So it allows for a lot of diversity across Islam.
Dr. Trubisky, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate your enlightening us on these topics.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about this beautiful religion.
And we'll be back soon.